play it by ear, Richie boy," he said. "That's what I've been doing ever since I left New Hampshire, playing it by ear." They reached the porch. Richard clutched Jack's shoulder with panicky strength. Jack turned toward him wearily. Richard's patented Kansas City clutch was something else that was getting old in a big hurry. "What?" Jack asked.
"This is a dream, all right," Richard said, "and I can prove it."
"How?"
"We're not talking English anymore, Jack. We're talking some language, and we're speaking it perfectly, but it's not English."
"Yeah," Jack said. "Weird, isn't it?" He started up the steps again, leaving Richard standing below him, gape-mouthed. After a moment or two, Richard recovered and scrambled up the steps after Jack. The boards were warped and loose and splintery. Stalks of that richly bearded grain grass grew up through some of them. Off in the deep darkness, both boys could hear the sleepy hum of insects. It was not the reedy scratch of crickets, but a sweeter sound. So much was sweeter over here, Jack thought. The outside lamp was now behind them. Their shadows ran ahead of them across the porch and then made right angles to climb the door. There was an old, faded sign on that door. For a moment it seemed to Jack to be written in strange Cyrillic letters, as indecipherable as Russian. Then they came clear, and the word was no surprise, Depot. Jack raised his hand to knock, then shook his head a little. No, he would not knock. This was not a private dwelling. The sign said Depot, and that was a word he associated with public buildings, places to wait for Greyhound buses and Amtrak trains, loading zones for the friendly skies. He pushed the door open. Friendly lamplight and a decidedly unfriendly voice came out onto the porch together.
"Get away, you devil!"
the cracked voice screeched.
"Get away! I'm going in the morning, I swear! The train's in the shed, go away! I swore I'd go, and I will go, so now ye go! Go and leave me some peace!"
Jack frowned. Richard gaped. The room was clean, but very old. The boards were so warped that the walls seemed almost to ripple. A picture of a stagecoach, which looked almost as big as a whaling ship, hung on one wall. An ancient counter, its flat surface almost as ripply as the walls, ran across the middle of the room, splitting it in two. Behind it, on the far wall, was a slate board with "Stage Arrives" written above one column and "Stage Leaves" written above the other. Looking at the ancient board, Jack guessed it had been a good long time since any information had been written there. He thought that if someone tried to write on it with even a piece of soft chalk, the slate would crack in pieces and fall to the weathered floor. Standing on one side of the counter was the biggest hourglass Jack had ever seen. It was as big as a magnum of champagne and filled with green sand.
"Leave me alone, can't ya? I've promised ye I'd go, and I will. Please, Morgan, for your mercy, I've promised. And if you don't believe me, look in the shed. The train is ready. I swear the train is ready."
There was a good deal more gabble and gobble in this same vein. The large, elderly man spouting it was cringing in the far right-hand corner of the room. Jack guessed the oldster's height at 6'3" at least, even in his present servile posture. The depot's low ceiling was only 4 inches or so above his head. He might have been 70, he might have been a fairly well-preserved 80. A snowy white beard began under his eyes and cascaded down over his breast in a spray of baby-fine hair. His shoulders were broad, although now so slumped that they looked as if someone had broken them by forcing him to carry heavy weights over the course of many long years. Deep crow's feet radiated out from the corners of his eyes. Deep fissures undulated on his forehead. His complexion was waxy yellow. He was wearing a white kilt shot through with bright scarlet threads, and he was obviously scared almost to death. He was brandishing a stout staff, but with no authority at all. Jack glanced sharply around at Richard when the old man mentioned the name of Richard's father, but Richard was currently beyond noticing such fine points.
"I am not who you think I am," Jack said, advancing toward the old man.
"Get away!"
he shrieked.
"None of your guff! I guess the divil can put on a pleasing face. Get away! I'll do it! She's ready to go first thing in the morning. I said I'd do it, and I mean to. Now get away, can't ya?"
The knapsack was now a haversack hanging from Jack's arm. As Jack reached the counter, he rummaged in it, pushing aside the mirror and a number of the jointed money sticks. His fingers closed around what he wanted, and he brought it out. It was the coin Captain Farron had given him so long ago, the coin with the queen on one side and the griffin on the other. He slammed it down on the counter, and the room's mellow light caught the lovely profile of Laura de Loessian. Again he was struck with wonder by the similarity of that profile to the profile of his mother. Did they look that much alike at the beginning? Is it just that I see the similarities more as I think about them more? Or am I actually bringing them together somehow, making them one? The old man cringed back even farther as Jack came forward to the counter. It began to seem as though he might push himself right through the back of the building. His words began to pour out in a hysterical flood. When Jack slammed the coin down on the counter like a bad man in a Western movie demanding a drink, he suddenly stopped talking. He stared at the coin, his eyes widening, the spit-shiny corners of his mouth twitching. His widening eyes rose to Jack's face and really saw him for the first time.
"Jason," he whispered in a trembling voice. Its former weak bluster was gone. It trembled now not with fear but with awe. "Jason!"
"No," he said. "My name is—" Then he stopped, realizing that the word which would come out in this strange language was not Jack, but
"Jason!"
the old man cried, and fell on his knees.
"Jason, you've come! You've come, and I will be well! Aye, I will be well! I will be well! And our manner of things will be well!"
"Hey," Jack said, "hey, really,
Jason, Jason's come, and the queen will be well, aye, our manner of things will be well."
Jack, less prepared to cope with this weepy adoration than he had been to deal with the old depot keeper's terrified truculence, turned toward Richard. But there was no help there. Richard had stretched out on the floor to the left of the door, and had either gone to sleep or was giving a damned good facsimile thereof. "Oh, shit," Jack groaned. The old man was on his knees, babbling and weeping. The situation was rapidly passing from the realms of the merely ridiculous into those of the cosmically comic. Jack found a flip-up partition and went behind the counter. "Ah, rise, you good and faithful servant," Jack said. He wondered blackly if Christ or Buddha had ever had problems like this. "On your feet, fella."
"Jason! Jason!"
the old man sobbed. His white hair obscured Jack's sandaled feet as he bent over them and began to kiss them. They weren't little kisses either, but good old spooning in the hayloft smackers. Jack began to giggle helplessly. He had managed to get them out of Illinois, and here they were in a ramshackle depot at the center of a great field of grain which wasn't quite wheat, somewhere in the outposts, and Richard was sleeping by the door, and this strange old man was kissing his feet and his beard tickled.
"Rise!"
Jack yelled, giggling. He tried to step back but hit the counter. "Rise up, oh good servant! Get on your frigging feet! Get up! That's enough!"
"Jason, smack! Ah, we be well, smack, smack! And our manner of things will be well," Jack thought crazily, giggling as the old man kissed his toes through the sandals.
"I didn't know they read Robert Burns over here in the territories, but I guess they must. Smack, smack, smack. Oh, no more of this. I really can't stand it."
"Rise!"
he bellowed at the top of his voice. And the old man finally stood before him, trembling and weeping, unable to meet Jack's eye. But his amazingly broad shoulders had come up a bit, had lost that broken look, and Jack was obscurely glad of that. It was an hour or better before Jack had managed a coherent run of conversation with the old man. They would begin talking, and then Anders, who was a liveryman by trade, would go off on another of his "Oh, Jason, my Jason, how great thou art" jags, and Jack would have to quiet him down as quickly as he could, certainly before the feet-kissing started again. Jack liked the old man, however, and sympathized. In order to sympathize, all he had to do was imagine how he would feel if Jesus or Buddha turned up at the local car wash or in the school lunch line. And he had to acknowledge one other clear and present fact. There was a part of him which was not entirely surprised by Anders' attitude. Although he felt like Jack, he was coming more and more to also feel like the other one. But he had died. That was true. Undeniably true. Jason had died, and Morgan Avoris had probably had something to do with his death. But guys like Jason had a way of coming back, didn't they? Jack considered the time it took to get Anders talking well spent, if only because it allowed him to be sure that Richard wasn't shamming, that he really had gone back to sleep again. This was good, because Anders had a lot to say about Morgan. Once, he said, this had been the last stage depot in the known world. It went by the euphonious name of Outpost Depot. Beyond here, he said, the world became a monstrous place. Monstrous how? Jack asked.
I don't know,
Anders said, lighting his pipe. He looked out into the darkness, and his face was bleak.
There are stories about the blasted lands, but each is apt to be different from each, and they always begin something like, I know a man who met a man who was lost on the edge of the blasted lands for 3 days, and he said, but I never heard a story that begun, I was lost on the edge of the blasted lands for 3 days, and I say, you ken the difference, Jason, my lord.
I ken it, Jack said slowly. The blasted lands. Just the sound of that had raised the hairs on his arms and the nape of his neck. No one knows what they are, then?
Not for sure, Anders said. But if even a quarter of what I've heard is true...
What have you heard?
That there are monstrosities out there that make the things in Oris's orpits look almost normal. That there are balls of fire that go rolling across the hills in empty places, leaving long black trails behind them. The trails are black in the daytime anyway, but I've heard they glow at night. And if a man gets too close to one of the fireballs, he gets terrible sick. He loses his air, and sores are apt to raise all over his body, and then he begins to vomit, and mayhap he gets better, but more often he only vomits and vomits until his stomach ruptures and his throat bursts, and then...
Anders rose.
My lord, why do you look so? Have you seen something out the window? Have you seen a spook along those double-damned tracks?
Anders looked wildly toward the window.
Radiation poisoning, Jack thought. He doesn't know it, but he's described the symptoms of radiation poisoning almost to a T.
They had studied both nuclear weapons and the consequences of exposure to radiation in a physical science mod the year before, because his mother was at least casually involved in both the nuclear freeze movement and the movement to prevent the proliferation of nuclear power plants, Jack had paid very close attention. How well, he thought, how well radiation poisoning fitted with the whole idea of the blasted lands. And then he realized something else as well. The West was where the first tests had been carried out, where the prototype of the Hiroshima bomb had been hung from a tower and then exploded, where any number of suburbs inhabited only by department store mannequins had been destroyed so the Army could get a more or less accurate idea of what a nuclear explosion and the resulting firestorm would really do. And in the end, they had returned to Utah and Nevada, among the last of the real American territories, and had simply resumed testing underground. There was, he knew, a lot of government land out there in those great wastes, those tangles of buttes and mesas and crenellated badlands, and bombs were not all they were testing out there. How much of that shit would Sloat bring over here if the Queen died? How much of that shit had he already brought? Was this stage line come railhead part of the shipping system for it?
You don't look good, my lord. Not at all. You look as white as a sheet. I'll take an oath that you do.
I'm fine, Jack said slowly. Sit down. Go on with your story, and light your pipe. It's gone out. Anders took his pipe from his mouth, relit it, and looked from Jack to the window again. And right now his face was not just bleak. It was haggard with fright.
But I'll know soon enough if the stories are true, I suppose.
Why is that?
"'Because I start through the blasted lands tomorrow morning at first light,' Anders said. "'I start through the blasted lands driving Morgan of Horus's devil machine in yon shed "'and carrying God alone knows what sort of hideous devil's work.'
Jack stared at him, his heart pumping hard, the blood humming in his head. Where? How far? To the ocean? The big water? Anders nodded slowly.
Aye, he said, to the water.
And? His voice dropped, became a strengthless whisper. His eyes rolled toward the dark shadows, as if he feared some nameless thing might be peering in, watching, eavesdropping.
And there Morgan will meet me, and we're to take his goods on.
On to where? Jack asked.
To the Black Hotel,
Anders finished, in a low, trembling voice. Jack felt the urge to break into wild cackles of laughter again. The Black Hotel, it sounded like the title of a lurid mystery novel. And yet, all of this had begun at a hotel, hadn't it? The Alhambra in New Hampshire, on the Atlantic coast. Was there some other hotel, perhaps even another rambling old Victorian monstrosity of a hotel on the Pacific coast? Was that where his long, strange adventure was supposed to end, in some analogue of the Alhambra, and with a seedy amusement park close at hand? This idea was terribly persuasive. In an odd, yet precise way, it even seemed to pick up the idea of twinners and twinning.
"'Why do you look at me so, my lord?'
Anders sounded agitated and upset. Jack shifted his gaze away quickly.
"'I'm sorry,' he said. "'I was just thinking.'
He smiled reassuringly, and the liveryman smiled tentatively back at him. "'And I wish you'd stop calling me that.'
"'Calling you what, my lord?'
"'My lord.'
"'My lord?'
Anders looked puzzled. He was not echoing what Jack had said, but asking for clarification. Jack had a feeling that if he tried to push on with this, he would end up in the middle of a who's-on-first-what's-on-second sort of sketch.
"'Never mind,' Jack said.
He leaned forward. "'I want you to tell me everything. Can you do that?'
"'I'll try, my lord,' Anders said.
His words came slowly at first. He was a single man who had spent his entire life in the outposts, and he was not used to talking much at the best of times. Now he had been commanded to speak by a boy whom he considered to be at least royalty, and perhaps even something like a god. But little by little his words began to come faster, and by the end of his inconclusive but terribly provocative tale, the words were nearly pouring out. Jack had no trouble following the tale he told, in spite of the man's accent, which his mind kept translating into a sort of ersatz Robert Burns burr. Anders knew Morgan because Morgan was, quite simply, Lord of the Outposts. His real title, Morgan of Horus, was not so grand, but as a practical matter the two came to nearly the same. Horus was the easternmost cantonment of the outposts, and the only really recognized part of that large, grassy area. Because he ruled Horus utterly and completely, Morgan ruled the rest of the outposts by default. Also, the bad wolves had begun to gravitate to Morgan in the last 15 years or so. At first that meant little, because there were only a few bad, except the word Anders used also sounded a bit like rabid to Jack's ear, wolves. But in later years there had been more and more of them, and Anders said he had heard tales that since the queen had fallen ill, more than half the tribe of skin-turning shepherds were rotten with the sickness. Nor were these the only creatures at Morgan of Horus's command, Anders said. There were others, even worse. Some, it was told, could drive a man mad at a single look. Jack thought of Elroy, the boogeyman of the Oatly Tap, and shuddered. "'Does this part of the outposts we're in have a name?' Jack asked.
"'My lord?'
"'This part we're in now?'
"'No real name, my lord, but I've heard people call it Ellis Breaks.'
"'Ellis Breaks,' Jack said. A picture of territory's geography, vague and probably in many ways incorrect, was finally beginning to take shape in Jack's mind. There were the territories which corresponded to the American East, the outposts which corresponded to the American Midwest and Great Plains, Alice Breaks, Illinois, Nebraska, and the Blasted Lands, which corresponded to the American West. He looked at Anders so long and so fixedly that at last the liveryman began to stir uneasily again. "I'm sorry," Jack said. "Go on." His father, Anders said, had been the last stage driver who drove out east from Outpost Depot. Anders had been his prentice. But even in those days, he said, there were great confusions and upheavals in the east. The murder of the old king and the short war which had followed it had seen the beginning of those upheavals, and although the war had ended with the installation of good Queen Laura, the upheavals had gone on ever since, seeming to work their way steadily eastward out of the spoiled and twisted blasted lands. There were some, Anders said, who believed the evil had begun all the way west. "I'm not sure I understand you," Jack said, although in his heart he thought he did. "At Land's End," Anders said, "at the edge of the big water, where I'm bound to go." In other words, it began in the same place my father came from. My father and me and Richard and Morgan, old Bloat. The troubles, Anders said, had come to the outposts, and now the wolf tribe was partly rotten. Just how rotten, none could say, but the liveryman told Jack he was afraid that the rot would be the end of them if it didn't stop soon. The upheavals had come here, and now they had even reached the east, where, he had heard, the queen lay ill and near death.
"That's not true, is it, my lord?" Anders asked, almost begged.
Jack looked at him. "Should I know how to answer that?" he asked.
"Of course," Anders said. "Are you not her son?"
For a moment, the entire world seemed to become very quiet. The sweet hum of the bugs outside stilled. Richard seemed to pause between heavy, sluggish breaths. Even his own heart seemed to pause, perhaps that most of all. Then, his voice perfectly even, he said, "Yes, I am her son. And it's true. She's very ill."
"But dying,"
Anders persisted, his eyes nakedly pleading now.
"Is she dying, my lord?"
Jack smiled a little and said, "That remains to be seen." Anders said that until the troubles began, Morgan of Orris had been a little-known frontier lord and no more. He had inherited his comic opera title from a father who had been a greasy, evil-smelling buffoon. Morgan's father had been something of a laughingstock while alive, Anders went on, and had even been a laughingstock in his manner of dying.
"He was taken with the squitters after a day of drinking peach-fruit wine and died while on the trots."
People had been prepared to make the old man's son a laughingstock as well, but the laughing had stopped soon after the hangings in Orris began. And when the troubles began in the years after the death of the old king, Morgan had risen in importance as a star of evil omen rises in the sky. All of this meant little this far out in the outposts. These great empty spaces, Anders said, made politics seem unimportant. Only the deadly change in the wolf tribe made a practical difference to them, and since most of the bad wolves went to the other place, even that didn't make much difference to them.
"It fashes us little, my lord," was what Jack's ears insisted they had heard.
Then, not long after the news of the queen's illness had reached this far west, Morgan had sent out a crew of grotesque, twisted slaves from the ore pits back east. These slaves were tended by stolen wolves and other stranger creatures. Their foreman was a terrible man who carried a whip. He had been here almost constantly when the work began, but then he had disappeared. Anders, who had spent most of those terrible weeks and months cowering in his house, which was some 5 miles south of here, had been delighted to see him go. He had heard rumors that Morgan had called the man with the whip back east, where affairs were reaching some great point of climax. Anders didn't know if this was true or not, and didn't care. He was simply glad that the man, who was sometimes accompanied by a scrawny, somehow gruesome-looking little boy, was gone. "'His name?' Jack demanded. "'What was his name?'
"'My lord, I don't know. "'The wolves called him He of the Lashes. "'The slaves just called him the Devil. "'I'd say they were both right.'
"'Did he dress like a dandy? "'Velvet coat, shoes with buckles on the tops, maybe?' "'Anders was nodding. "'Did he wear a lot of strong perfume?'
"'Aye, he did.'
"'And the whip had little rawhide strings with metal caps on them?'
"'Aye, my lord, an evil whip, and he was fearsome good with it, aye, he was.'
"'It was Osmond. It was Sunlight Gardener. He was here overseeing some project for Morgan. Then the queen got sick, and Osmond was called back to the summer palace, where I first made his cheerful acquaintance.' "'His son,' Jack said. "'What did his son look like?'
"'Skinny,' Anders said slowly. "'One eye was afloat.' "'That's all I can remember. "'My lord, the whipman's son was hard to see. "'The wolves seemed more afraid of him than of his father, "'although the son carried no whip. "'They said he was dim.'
"'Dim?' Jack mused.
"'Yes. "'It is their word for one who is hard to see, "'no matter how hard you look for that one. "'Invisibility is impossible, so the wolves say. "'But one can make himself dim if only he knows the trick of it.' Most wolves do, and this little horse knew it too. So all I remember is how thin he was, and that floating eye, and that he was ugly as black syphilitic sin.
Anders paused.
He liked to hurt things, little things. He used to take them under the porch, and I'd hear the most awful screams.
Anders shuddered.
That was one of the reasons I kept to my house, you know. I don't like to hear wee animals in pain. It makes me feel terrible bad, it does.
Everything Anders said raised 100 fresh questions in Jack's mind. He would particularly have liked to know all that Anders knew about the wolves. Just hearing of them woke simultaneous pleasure and a deep, dully painful longing for his wolf in his heart. But time was short. This man was scheduled to drive west into the blasted lands in the morning. A horde of crazy scholars led by Morgan himself might burst through from what the liverymen called the other place at any moment. Richard might wake up and want to know who this Morgan was they were discussing and who this dim fellow was. This dim fellow who sounded suspiciously like the fellow who had lived next door to him in Nelson House. They came, he prompted. This crew came, and Osmond was their foreman, at least until he was called away, or whenever he had to lead the devotions at night chapel back in Indiana.
"'My lord?'
Anders' face was again ponderous with puzzlement. "'They came and they built—' "'What?' He was sure he already knew the answer to this, but he wanted to hear Anders himself say it.
"'Why, the tracks?' Anders said. "'The tracks going west into the blasted lands. The tracks I must travel myself tomorrow.'
He shuddered. No, Jack said. A hot, terrible excitement exploded in his chest like a sun, and he rose to his feet. Again there was that click in his head, that terrible, persuasive feeling of great things coming together. Anders fell on his knees with a crash as a terrible, beautiful light filled Jack's face. Richard stirred at the sound and sat sleepily up. Not you. Jack said. Me and him. He pointed at Richard.
Jack?
Richard looked at him with sleepy, near-sighted confusion. What are you talking about? And why is that man sniffing the floor?
My lord, your will, of course, but I don't understand.
Not you, Jack said. Us. We'll take the train for you.
But my lord, why?
Anders managed, not yet daring to look up. Jack Sawyer looked out into the darkness. "'Because,' he said, "'I think there's something at the end of the tracks, at the end of the tracks or near the end, that I have to get.'" Interlude. Sloat in This World, 4. On the 10th of December, a bundled-up Morgan Sloat was sitting on the uncomfortable little wooden chair beside Lily Sawyer's bed. He was cold, so he had his heavy cashmere coat wrapped around him and his hands thrust deep into its pockets. But he was having a much better time than his appearance suggested. Lily was dying. She was going out, away, to that place from which you never came back, not even if you were a queen in a football field-sized bed. Lily's bed was not so grand, and she did not in the least resemble a queen. Illness had subtracted her good looks, had skinned down her face, and aged her a quick 20 years. Sloat let his eyes roam appreciatively over the prominent ridges of bone about her eyes, the tortoise-like shell of her forehead. Her ravaged body barely made a lump beneath the sheets and blankets. Sloat knew that the Alhambra had been well paid to leave Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer alone, for it was he who had paid them. They no longer bothered to send heat up to her room. She was the hotel's only guest. Besides the desk clerk and cook, the only employees still in the Alhambra were 3 Portuguese maids who spent all their time cleaning the lobby. It must have been the maids who kept Lily piled high with blankets. Sloat himself had commandeered the suite across the hall and ordered the desk clerk and the maids to keep a close eye on Lily. To see if she would open her eyes, he said, "You're looking better, Lily. I really think I see signs of improvement." Without moving anything but her mouth, Lily said, "I don't know why you pretend to be human, Sloat." "I'm the best friend you have," Sloat responded. Now she did open her eyes, and they were not dull enough to suit him. "Get out of here," she whispered. "You're obscene." "I'm trying to help you, and I wish you'd remember that. I have all the papers, Lily. All you have to do is sign them. Once you do, you and your son are taken care of for life." Sloat regarded Lily with an expression of satisfied gloom. "I haven't had much luck in locating Jack, by the way. Spoken to him lately?" "You know I haven't," she said, and did not weep as he had hoped. "I really do think the boy ought to be here, don't you?" "Piss up a stick," Lily said. "I think I will use your bathroom, if you don't mind," he said, and stood up. Lily closed her eyes again, ignoring him. "I hope he's staying out of trouble, anyhow," Sloat said, slowly walking down the side of the bed. "Terrible things happen to boys on the road." Lily still did not respond. "Things I hate to think about." He reached the end of the bed and continued on to the bathroom door. Lily lay under her sheets and blankets like a crumpled piece of tissue paper. Sloat went into the bathroom. He rubbed his hands together, gently closed the door, and turned on both taps over the sink. From the pocket of his suit coat, he extracted a small brown 2-gram vial, from his inner jacket pocket a small case containing a mirror, a razor blade, and a short brass straw. Onto the mirror, he tapped about 1/8 gram of the purest Peruvian flake cocaine he'd been able to find. Then he chopped it ritualistically with his blade, forming it into 2 stubby lines. He snorted the lines through the brass straw, gasped, inhaled sharply, and held his breath for a second or two. Ah! His nasal passages opened up as wide as tunnels. Way back there, a drip began to deliver the goodies. Sloat ran his hands under the water, then, for the sake of his nose, drew a little of the moisture on his thumb and index finger up into his nostrils. He dried his hands and his face. "That lovely train," he allowed himself to think. "That lovely, lovely train. I bet I'm prouder of it than I am of my own son." Morgan Sloat reveled in the vision of his precious train, which was the same in both worlds, and the first concrete manifestation of his long-held plan to import modern technology into the territories, arriving in Point Venuti loaded with its useful cargo. Point Venuti. Sloat smiled as the coke blasted through his brain, bringing its usual message that all would be well, all would be well. Little Jackie Sawyer would be a very lucky boy ever to leave the odd little town of Point Venuti. In fact, he'd be lucky ever to get there in the first place, considering that he'd have to make his way across the blasted lands. But the drug reminded Sloat that in some ways he'd prefer Jack to make it to dangerous, warped little Point Venuti. He'd even prefer Jack to survive his exposure to the Black Hotel, which was not merely boards and nails, bricks and stone, but was also somehow alive, because it was possible that he might walk out with a talisman in his thieving little hands. And if that were to happen, yes, if that absolutely wonderful event were to take place, all would indeed be well, and both Jack Sawyer and the talisman would be broken in half. And he, Morgan Sloat, would finally have the canvas his talents deserved. For a second he saw himself spreading his arms over starry vastnesses, over worlds folded together like lovers on a bed, over all that the talisman protected, and all that he had coveted so when he'd bought the Agincourt years back. Jack could get all that for him. Sweetness, glory. To celebrate this thought, Sloat brought the vial out of his pocket again, and did not bother with the ritual of razor and mirror, but simply used the attached little spoon to raise the medicinal white powder to first one nostril, then the other. Sweetness. Yes. Sniffing, he came back into the bedroom. Lily appeared slightly more animated, but his mood now was so good that even this evidence of her continuing life did not darken it. Bright and oddly hollow within their circles of bone, her eyes followed him. "Uncle Bloat has a new loathsome habit," she said. "And you're dying," he said. "Which one would you choose?" "Do enough of that stuff and you'll be dying too." Undeterred by her hostility, Sloat returned to the rickety wooden chair. "For God's sake, Lily, grow up," he said. "Everybody does coke now. You're out of touch. You've been out of touch for years. You want to try some?" He lifted the vial from his pocket and swung it by the chain attached to the little spoon. "Get out of here." Sloat waggled the vial closer to her face. Lily sat up in bed as smartly as a striking snake and spat in his face. "Bitch!" he recoiled, grabbing for his handkerchief as the wad of spittle slid down his cheek. "If that crap is so wonderful, why do you have to sneak into the toilet to take it? Don't answer, just leave me alone. I don't want to see you again, Bloat. Take your fat ass out of here." "You're going to die alone, Lily," he said, now perversely filled with a cold, hard joy. "You're going to die alone, and this comic little town is going to give you a pauper's burial, and your son is going to be killed because he can't possibly handle what's lying in wait for him, and no one will ever hear of either one of you again." He grinned at her. His plump hands were balled into white, hairy fists. "Remember Asher Dondorf, Lily? Our client? The sidekick on that series Flanagan and Flanagan? I was reading about him in the Hollywood Reporter, some issue a few weeks ago. Shot himself in his living room, but his aim wasn't too cool, because instead of killing himself, he just blew away the roof of his mouth and put himself in a coma. Might hang on for years, I hear, just rotting away." He leaned toward her, his forehead corrugating. "You and good old Asher have a lot in common, it seems to me." She stonily looked back. Her eyes seemed to have crawled back inside her head, and at that moment she resembled some hard-bitten old frontier woman with a squirrel rifle in one hand and scripture in the other. "My son is going to save my life," she said. "Jack is going to save my life, and you won't be able to stop him."
"Well, we'll see, won't we?" Sloat answered. "We'll just see about that."
Chapter 35. The Blasted Lands.
"But will you be safe, my lord?" Anders asked, kneeling down before Jack with his white and red kilt pulled out around him like a skirt.
"Jack?" Richard asked, his voice a whiny, irrelevant skirl of sound.
"Would you be safe yourself?" Jack asked. Anders twisted his big white head sideways and squinted up at Jack as if he had just asked a riddle. He looked like a huge, puzzled dog. I mean, I'll be about as safe as you would be yourself. That's all I mean.
But, my lord, Jack,
came Richard's querulous voice again, I fell asleep, and now I should be awake. But we're still in this weird place, so I'm still dreaming. But I want to be awake, Jack. I don't want to have this dream anymore. No, I don't want to. And that's why you busted your damn glasses, Jack said to himself. Aloud, he said, This isn't a dream, Richie boy. We're about to hit the road. We're going to take a train ride.
Huh?
Richard said, rubbing his face and sitting up. If Anders resembled a big white dog in skirts, Richard looked like nothing so much as a newly awakened baby.
My lord Jason, Anders said.
Now he seemed as if he might weep with relief, Jack thought.
Is it your will? Is it your will to drive that devil machine through the blasted lands?
It sure is, Jack said.
Where are we? Richard said. Are you sure they're not following us?
Jack turned toward him. Richard was sitting up on the undulating yellow floor, blinking stupidly, terror still drifting about him like a fog. Okay, he said, I'll answer your question. We're in a section of the territories called Ellis Breaks.
My head hurts, Richard said.
He had closed his eyes. And, Jack went on, we're going to take this man's train all the way through the blasted lands to the Black Hotel, or as close to it as we can get. That's it, Richard, believe it or not. And the sooner we do it, the sooner we'll get away from whatever just might be trying to find us.
Etheridge, Richard whispered. Mr. Duffery.
He looked around the mellow interior of the depot, as if he expected all their pursuers to suddenly pour through the walls. It's a brain tumor, you know, he said to Jack in a tone of perfect reasonableness. That's what it is, my headache.
My lord Jason,
old Anders was saying, bowing so low that his hair settled down on the rippling floorboards.
How good you are, oh high one, how good to your lowliest servant, how good to those who do not deserve your blessed presence.
He crawled forward, and Jack saw with horror that he was about to begin that moony foot-kissing all over again. Pretty far advanced, too, I'd say, Richard offered. Get up, please, Anders, Jack said, stepping back. Get up, come on, that's enough. The old man continued to crawl forward, babbling with his relief at not having to endure the blasted lands.
Arise, Jack bellowed.
Anders looked up, his forehead wrinkled.
Yes, my lord.
He slowly got up. Bring your brain tumor over here, Richard, Jack said. We're going to see if we can figure out how to drive this damn train. Anders had moved over behind the long, rippling counter and was rooting in a drawer.
I believe it works on devils, my lord, he said. Strange devils all hurtled down together. They do not appear to live, yet they do, aye.
He fetched out of the drawer the longest, fattest candle that Jack had ever seen. From a box atop the counter, Anders selected a foot-long, narrow, softwood strip, then lowered one of its ends into a glowing lamp. The strip of wood ignited, and Anders used it to light his enormous candle. Then he waved the match back and forth until the flame expired in a curl of smoke.
Devils? Jack asked. Strange square things. I believe the devils are contained therein. Sometimes how they spit and spark. I shall show this to you, Lord Jason.
Without another word, he swept toward the door, the warm glow of the candle momentarily erasing the wrinkles from his face. Jack followed him outside into the sweetness and amplitude of the deep territories. He remembered a photograph on the wall of Speedy Parker's office, a photograph even then filled with an inexplicable power, and realized that he was actually near the site of that photograph. Far off rose a familiar-looking mountain. Down the little knoll, the fields of grain rolled away in all directions, waving in smooth, wide patterns. Richard Sloat moved hesitantly beside Jack, rubbing his forehead. The silvery bands of metal, out of key with the rest of the landscape, stretched inexorably west.
"The shed is in back, my lord," Anders said softly, and almost shyly turned away toward the side of the depot.
Jack took another glance at the far-off mountain. Now it looked less like the mountain in Speedy's photograph. Newer. A western, not an eastern mountain. "What's with that Lord Jason business?" Richard whispered right into his ear. "He thinks he knows you." "It's hard to explain," Jack said. Richard tugged at his bandana, then clamped a hand on Jack's biceps, the old Kansas City clutch.
"What happened to the school, Jack? What happened to the dogs? Where are we?"
"Just come along," Jack said. "You're probably still dreaming."
"Yes," Richard said in the tone of purest relief. "Yes, that's it, isn't it? I'm still asleep. You told me all that crazy stuff about the territories, and now I'm dreaming about it."
"Yeah," Jack said, and set off after Anders. The old man was holding up the enormous candle like a torch and drifting down the rear side of the knoll toward another, slightly larger, octagonal wooden building. The two boys followed him through the tall yellow grass. Light spilled from another of the transparent globes, revealing that this second building was open at opposite ends, as if two matching faces of the octagon had been neatly sliced away. The silvery train tracks ran through these open ends. Anders reached the large shed and turned around to wait for the boys. With the flaring, sputtering, upheld candle, his long beard and odd clothes, Anders resembled a creature from legend or fairy, a sorcerer or wizard.
"It sits here as it has since it came, and may the demons drive it hence," Anders scowled at the boys, and all his wrinkles deepened. "Invention of hell, a foul thing, d'ye ken?"
He looked over his shoulder when the boys were before him. Jack saw that Anders did not even like being in the shed with the train.
"Half its cargo is aboard, and it too stinks of hell."
Jack stepped into the open end of the shed, forcing Anders to follow him. Richard stumbled after, rubbing his eyes. The little train sat, pointing west on the tracks, an odd-looking engine, a boxcar, a flat car covered with a straining tarp. From this last car came the smell Anders so disliked. It was a wrong smell, not of the territories, both metallic and greasy. Richard immediately went to one of the interior angles of the shed, sat down on the floor with his back to the wall, and closed his eyes.
"Do you ken its workings, my lord?" Anders asked in a low voice.
Jack shook his head and walked up along the tracks to the head of the train. Yes, there were Anders's demons. They were box batteries, just as Jack had supposed, 16 of them in two rows strung together in a metal container supported by the cab's first four wheels. The entire front part of the train looked like a more sophisticated version of a delivery boy's bicycle cart. But where the bicycle itself should have been was a little cab which reminded Jack of something else, something he could not immediately identify.
"The demons talk to the upright stick," Anders said from behind him.
Jack hoisted himself up into the little cab. The stick, Anders had mentioned, was a gear shift set in a slot with three notches. Then Jack knew what the little cab resembled. The whole train ran on the same principle as a golf cart. Battery-powered, it had only three gears, forward, neutral, and reverse. It was the only sort of train that might possibly work in the territories, and Morgan Sloat must have had it specially constructed for him.
"The demons in the boxes spit and spark and talk to the stick, and the stick moves the train, my lord."
Anders hovered anxiously beside the cab, his face contorting into an astonishing display of wrinkles. "You were going to leave in the morning?" Jack asked the old man.
"Aye."
"But the train is ready now."
"Yes, my lord."
Jack nodded and jumped down. "What's the cargo?"
"Devil things," Anders said grimly, "for the bad wolves to take to the Black Hotel."
I'd be a jump ahead of Morgan Sloat if I left now, Jack thought, and looked uneasily over at Richard, who had managed to put himself asleep again. If it weren't for pig-headed, hypochondriacal, rational Richard, he would never have stumbled onto Sloat's choo-choo. And Sloat would have been able to use the devil things, weapons of some kind, surely, against him as soon as he got near the Black Hotel. For the hotel was the end of his quest. He was sure of that now. And all of that seemed to argue that Richard, as helpless and annoying as he now was, was going to be more important to his quest than Jack had ever imagined. The son of Sawyer and the son of Sloat, the son of Prince Philip Sawtell and the son of Morgan of Orris. For an instant the world wheeled above Jack, and he snagged a second's insight that Richard might just be essential to whatever he was going to have to do in the Black Hotel. Then Richard snuffled and let his mouth drop open, and the feeling of momentary comprehension slipped away from Jack. "Let's have a look at those devil things," he said. He whirled around and marched back down the length of the train, along the way noticing for the first time that the floor of the octagonal shed was in two sections. Most of it was one round circular mass, like an enormous dinner plate. Then there was a break in the wood, and what was beyond the perimeter of the circle extended to the walls. Jack had never heard of a roundhouse, but he understood the concept. The circular part of the floor could turn 180 degrees. Normally, trains or coaches came in from the east and returned in the same direction. The tarpaulin had been tied down over the cargo with thick brown cord so hairy it looked like steel wool. Jack strained to lift an edge, peered under, saw only blackness. "Help me," he said, turning to Anders. The old man stepped forward, frowning, and with one strong, deft motion released a knot. The tarpaulin loosened and sagged. Now, when Jack lifted its edge, he saw that half of the flat car held a row of wooden boxes, stenciled machine parts. "Guns," he thought. "Morgan is arming his rebel wolves." The other half of the space beneath the tarp was occupied by bulky rectangular packages of a squashy-looking substance, wrapped in layers of clear plastic sheeting. Jack had no idea what this substance might be, but he was pretty sure it wasn't Wonder Bread. He dropped the tarpaulin and stepped back, and Anders pulled at the thick rope and knotted it again. "We're going tonight," Jack said, having just decided this.
"But, my Lord Jason, the blasted lands, at night, do you ken?"
"I ken, all right," Jack said. "I ken that I'll need all the surprise I can whip up. Morgan and that man the wolves call He of the Lashes are going to be looking for me, and if I show up 12 hours before anybody's expecting this train, Richard and I might get away alive." Anders nodded gloomily, and again looked like an oversized dog accommodating itself to unhappy knowledge. Jack looked at Richard again, asleep, sitting up with his mouth open. As if he knew what was in Jack's mind, Anders, too, looked towards sleeping Richard. "Did Morgan of Orris have a son?" Jack asked.
"He did, my lord. Morgan's brief marriage had issue, a boy child named Rushton."
"And what became of Rushton, as if I couldn't guess?"
"He died," Anders said simply. "Morgan of Orris was not meant to be a father."
Jack shuddered, remembering how his enemy had torn his way through the air and nearly killed Wolf's entire herd. "We're going," he said. "Will you please help me get Richard into the cab, Anders?"
"My lord."
Anders hung his head, then lifted it and gave Jack a look of almost parental concern.
"The journey will require at least 2 days, perhaps 3, before you reach the western shore. Have you any food? Would you share my evening meal?"
Jack shook his head, impatient to begin this last leg of his journey to the Talisman. But then his stomach abruptly growled, reminding him of how long it had been since he had eaten anything but the ringdings and stale Famous Amos cookies in Albert the Blob's room. "Well," he said, "I suppose another half hour won't make any difference. Thank you, Anders. Help me get Richard up on his feet, will you?" And maybe, he thought, he wasn't so eager to cross the blasted lands after all. The two of them jerked Richard to his feet. Like the dormouse, he opened his eyes, smiled, and sagged back to sleep again. "Food," Jack said. "Real food. You up for that, chum?"
"I never eat in dreams," Richard answered with surreal rationality.
He yawned, then wiped his eyes. He gradually had found his feet, and no longer leaned against Anders and Jack.
"I am pretty hungry, though, to tell you the truth. I'm having a long dream, aren't I, Jack?"
He seemed almost proud of it.
Yep, said Jack.
Say, is that the train we're going to take? It looks like a cartoon.
Yep.
Can you drive that thing, Jack? It's in my dream, I know, but it's about as hard to operate as my old electric train set, Jack said. I can drive it, and so can you.
I don't want to, Richard said, and that cringing, whining tone came back into his voice again. I don't want to get on that train at all. I want to go back to my room.
Come and have some food instead, Jack said, and found himself leading Richard out of the shed. Then we're on our way to California. And so the territory showed one of its best faces to the boys immediately before they entered the blasted lands. Anders gave them thick, sweet slices of bread clearly made from the grain growing around the depot, kebabs of tender sections of meat, and plump, juicy, unfamiliar vegetables, a spicy, pink juice that Jack for some reason thought of as papaya, though he knew it was not. Richard chewed in a happy trance, the juice running down his chin, until Jack wiped it off for him.
California, he said once. I should have known.
Assuming that he was alluding to that state's reputation for craziness, Jack did not question him. He was more concerned about what the two of them were doing to Anders's presumably limited stock of food. But the old man kept nipping behind the counter, where he or his father before him had installed a small wood-burning stove, and returning with yet more food. Corn muffins, calf's foot jelly, things that looked like chicken legs but tasted of... what? Frankincense and myrrh? Flowers? The taste fairly exploded over his tongue, and he thought that he too might begin to drool. The three of them sat around a little table in the warm and mellow room. At the end of the meal, Anders almost shyly brought forth a heavy beaker half-filled with red wine. Feeling as if he were following someone else's script, Jack drank a small glassful. 2 hours later, beginning to feel drowsy, Jack wondered if that enormous meal had been an equally enormous error. First of all, there had been the departure from Ellis Brakes and the depot, which had not gone easily. Secondly, there was Richard, who threatened to go seriously crazy. And thirdly, and above all else, there were the blasted lands, which were far crazier than Richard would ever be, and which absolutely demanded concentrated attention. After the meal, the three of them had returned to the shed and the trouble had started. Jack knew that he was fearful of whatever might be ahead, and he now knew that fear was perfectly justified. And perhaps his trepidation had made him behave less well than he should have. The first difficulty had come when he tried to pay old Anders with the coin Captain Farron had given him. Anders responded as if his beloved Jason had just stabbed him in the back. Sacrilege. Outrage. By offering the coin, Jack had done more than merely insult the old liveryman. He had metaphorically smeared mud on his religion. Supernaturally restored divine beings apparently were not supposed to offer coins to their followers. Anders had been upset enough to smash his hand into the devil box, as he called the metal container for the rank of batteries, and Jack knew that Anders had been mightily tempted to strike another target besides the train. Jack had managed only a semi-truce. Anders did not want his apologies any more than he wanted his money. The old man had finally calmed down once he realized the extent of the boy's dismay, but he did not really return to his normal behavior until Jack speculated out loud that the Captain Farron coin might have other functions, other roles for him.
"You're not Jason entire," the old man gloomed. "Yet the Queen's coin may aid you toward your destiny."
He shook his head heavily. His farewell wave had been distinctly half-hearted. But a good portion of that had been due to Richard. What had begun as a sort of childish panic had quickly blossomed into full-blown terror. Richard had refused to get in the cab. Up until that moment he had mooned around the shed, not looking at the train, seemingly in an uncaring daze. Then he had realized that Jack was serious about getting him on that thing, and he had freaked. And, strangely, it had been the idea of ending up in California which had disturbed him most,
"No, no, can't,"
Richard had yelled when Jack urged him toward the train.
"I want to go back to my room."
"They might be following us, Richard," Jack said wearily. "We have to get going." He reached out and took Richard's arm. "This is all a dream, remember?"
Oh, my lard," Anders had said, moving aimlessly around in the big shed,
and Jack understood that for once the liveryman was not addressing him.
"I have to go back to my room," Richard squalled.
His eyes were clamped shut so tightly that a single painful crease ran from temple to temple. Echoes of Wolf again. Jack had tried to pull Richard toward the train, but Richard had stuck fast like a mule.
"I can't go there," he yelled.
"Well, you can't stay here either," Jack said. He made another futile effort at yanking Richard toward the train, and this time actually budged him a foot or two. "Richard," he said, "this is ridiculous. Do you want to be here alone? Do you want to be left alone in the territories?" Richard shook his head. "Then come with me. It's time. In 2 days we'll be in California."
"Bad business," Anders muttered to himself, watching the boys.
Richard simply continued to shake his head, offering a single comprehensive negative.
"I can't go there," he repeated. "I can't get on that train, and I can't go there."
"California?" Richard bit his mouth into a lipless seam and closed his eyes again.
"Oh, hell," Jack said. "Can you help me, Anders?"
The huge old man gave him a dismayed, almost disgusted look, then marched across the room and scooped up Richard in his arms, as if Richard were the size of a puppy. The boy let out a distinctly puppyish squeal. Anders dropped him onto the padded bench in the cab.
"Jack!"
Richard called, afraid that he somehow was going to wind up in the blasted lands all by himself.
"I'm here," Jack said, and was, in fact, already climbing into the other side of the cab.
"Thank you, Anders," he said to the old liveryman, who nodded gloomily and retreated back into a corner of the shed.
"Take care."
Richard had begun to weep, and Anders looked at him without pity. Jack pushed the ignition button, and two enormous blue sparks shot out from the devil box, just as the engine whirred into life.
"Here goes," Jack said, and eased the lever forward. The train began to glide out of the shed.
Richard whimpered and drew up his knees. Saying something like nonsense or impossible, Jack chiefly heard the hiss of the sibilance, he buried his face between his knees. He looked as though he were trying to become a circle. Jack waved to Anders, who waved back, and then they were out of the lighted shed and were covered only by the vast, dark sky. Anders's silhouette appeared in the opening through which they had gone, as if he had decided to run after them. The train was not capable of going more than 30 miles an hour, Jack thought, and at present was doing no better than 8 or 9. This seemed excruciatingly slow.
"West," Jack said to himself. "West, west, west."
Anders stepped back inside the shed, and his beard lay against his massive chest like a covering of frost. The train lurched forward, another sizzling blue spark snapped upward, and Jack turned around on the padded seat to see what was coming.
"No!"
Richard screamed, almost making Jack fall out of the cab.
"I can't go there!"
He had drawn his head up from his knees, but he wasn't seeing anything. His eyes were still clamped shut, and his whole face looked like a knuckle.
"Be quiet," Jack said.
Ahead, the tracks arrowed through the endless fields of waving grain. Dim mountains, old teeth floated in the western clouds. Jack glanced one last time over his shoulder, and saw the little oasis of warmth and light, which was the depot and the octagonal shed, slipping slowly backward behind him. Anders was a tall shadow in a lighted doorway. Jack gave a final wave, and the tall shadow waved too. Jack turned around again and looked over the immensity of grain, all that lyric distance. If this was what the blasted lands were like, the next 2 days were going to be positively restful. Of course they were not. Not like that at all. Even in the moonlit dark, he could tell that the grain was thinning out, becoming scrubby, About half an hour out of the depot, the change had begun. Even the color seemed wrong now, almost artificial. No longer the beautiful organic yellow he had seen before, but the yellow of something left too near a powerful heat source. The yellow of something with most of the life bleached out of it. Richard now had a similar quality. For a time he had hyperventilated, then he had wept as silently and shamelessly as a jilted girl, then he had fallen into a twitchy sleep. "Can't go back," he had muttered in his sleep, or such were the words Jack thought he had heard. In sleep, he seemed to dwindle. The whole character of the landscape had begun to alter. From the broad sweep of the plains in Ellis Breaks, the land had mutated to secretive little hollows and dark little valleys crowded with black trees. Huge boulders lay everywhere, skulls, eggs, giant teeth. The ground itself had changed, become much sandier. Twice the walls of the valleys grew up right alongside the tracks, and all Jack could see on either side were scrubby, reddish cliffs covered with low, creeping plants. Now and then he thought he saw an animal scurrying for cover, but the light was too weak and the animal too quick for him to identify it. But Jack had the eerie feeling that if the animal had frozen absolutely still in the middle of Rodeo Drive at high noon, he would still have been unable to identify it. A suggestion that the head was twice the size it should be, that this animal was better off hiding from human sight. By the time 90 minutes had elapsed, Richard was moaning in his sleep, and the landscape had passed into utter strangeness. The second time they had emerged from one of the claustrophobic valleys, Jack had been surprised by a sense of sudden openness. At first it was like being back in the territories again, the daydreams land. Then he had noticed, even in the dark, how the trees were stunted and bent. Then he had noticed the smell. Probably this had been slowly growing in his consciousness, but it was only after he had seen how the few trees scattered on the black plain had coiled themselves up like tortured beasts that he finally noticed the faint but unmistakable odor of corruption in the air. Corruption. Hellfire. Here the territory stank, or nearly. The odor of long dead flowers overlaid the land, and beneath it, as with Osmond, was a coarser, more potent odor. If Morgan, in either of his roles, had caused this, then he had, in some sense, brought death to the territories, or so Jack thought. Now there were no more intricate valleys and hollows. Now the land seemed a vast red desert. The queerly stunted trees dotted the sloping sides of this great desert. Before Jack, the twin silver rails of the tracks rolled on through darkened reddish emptiness. To his side, empty desert also rolled away through the dark. The red land seemed empty anyhow. For several hours, Jack never actually caught sight of anything larger than the deformed little animals concealing themselves on the slopes of the railway cuttings. But there were times when he thought he caught a sudden sliding movement in the corner of one eye, turned to see it, and it was gone. At first he thought he was being followed. Then, for a hectic time, no longer than 20 or 30 minutes, he imagined that he was being tracked by the dog things from Thayer School. Wherever he looked, something had just ceased to move, had nipped behind one of the coiled-up trees, or slipped into the sand. During this time, the wide desert of the blasted lands did not seem empty or dead, but full of slithery, hidden life. Jack pushed forward on the train's gear shift, as if that could help, and urged the little train to go faster, faster. Richard slumped in the L of his seat, whimpering. Jack imagined all those things neither canine or human, rushing toward them, and prayed that Richard's eyes would stay closed. "Now!" Richard yelled, still sleeping. Jack nearly fell out of the cab. He could see Etheridge and Mr. Duffery loping after them. They gained ground, their tongues lolling, their shoulders working. In the next second he realized that he had seen only shadows traveling beside the train. The loping schoolboys and their headmaster had winked out like birthday candles.
"Not there!"
Richard bawled. Jack inhaled carefully. They were safe. The dangers of the blasted lands were overrated, mainly literary. In not very many hours, the sun would lift itself up again. Jack raised his watch to the level of his eyes and saw that they had been on the train just under 2 hours. His mouth opened in a huge yawn, and he found himself regretting that he had eaten so much back in the depot. A piece of cake, he thought. This is going to be... And just as he was about to complete his paraphrase of the Burns lines old Anders had rather startlingly quoted, he saw the first of the fireballs, which destroyed his complacency forever.